Welcome back to Podcast Recovery, everyone. We are your hosts, David O.
And Eric V.
Today we are joined by another fellow David. How are you doing today?
I am chilling.
Nice, man.
Hebrew slave out here in the...
Oh, yeah. I'm sure it's hot as hell down in Georgia.
Oh, yeah, man. So fucking hot.
All right. So I was about to ask you where you're from, but I just totally blew the answer. You're from Georgia, originally from California?
Right.
All right. Well, glad you're with us today. And when were you first introduced to recovery?
As a kid, with my dad being a habitual drunk driver in the military, judges always said, okay, well, DUI, we're going to let your unit handle it, but we're going to send you to 90 meetings in 90 days. So I was always that kid in the back corner coloring or reading a comic book.
Nice.
And then he'd be half drunk by the time we got home. So.
Oof. Wasn't working too well. And how long
have you,
how long have you been sober?
Since 2014, July, September 6th. I don't know why you want to say July.
All right. Well, that's fucking awesome, man. And without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to you to share your story with us. So take her away.
My name is Dave B. I have a sobriety date of September 6th, 2014. I have two sponsors because
nice.
Someone like me needs two sponsors.
Oh, yeah.
I have a grand sponsor, and that's as far back as my lineage goes. I'm blessed to be what people call a one-chip wonder.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm lucky like that, my higher power's looking out for me.
Yeah.
Starting at the beginning, my parents were separated most of my life.
Mm.
My dad was always either stationed here or there, and usually I went with him. Sometimes my mom would follow later. Most of the time, she just stayed wherever we left.
Mm-hmm.
Dad had a lot of parties. So, I mean, a lot of parties.
Mm.
Which
branch of the military?
My mom was always great. Air Force. My dad was Air Force. I'm Army.
Okay.
But my mom was always more straight-laced.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things they always preached was, don't worry about a person's color, look at their character.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way I grew up. And then even in my teenage years, that's the way it was. So I partied with everybody. Jocks, blacks, whites, Mexicans, it didn't matter. Being in California. Later on, I was supposed to graduate 1 year, ended up getting in trouble, and instead of dropping out of school, I moved to Georgia so I could graduate. So I also have the dubious tag of being a super senior because I love school that much.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Take it around for a couple years and then decided to join the Army.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, I was already drinking a lot. And alcohol was always my drug of choice. So I dabbled. Well, not dabbled, but I indulged in a lot of recreational drugs. Let's see. Right after I joined the Army, wrecked a couple cars, drunk driving. Somehow, all the years that I was drinking and driving, I never ended up with a DUI. Don't ask me how. Don't ask me why. I thank my higher power for it.
Yeah.
And then, let's see. After my first deployment, we came back from Iraq. And even then, I knew that I had a drinking problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched some people. They went way deep into the Bible or their religion, and some of us went deeper into the bottle.
Yeah.
I definitely didn't choose religion. By the time I came back from my fourth deployment, I was convinced that God had turned his back on me, that there was no God, there was no Jesus. And really, the only time I prayed was before we would roll out the gate or before I would eat.
Yeah.
And I remember now looking back on it, I remember before I would eat every meal, I'd always say, God, please give me the strength to finish this food. Mm. And let it give me the patience that I don't slap the shit out of someone today.
Yeah.
At the time, my wife and I only had one daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And as she grew older, I thought she was weak. As crazy as it sounds, but I thought she was weak because she was going to counseling as a kid because of my drinking.
Oh, wow.
You know, I never put that it was my drinking causing her to go to counseling.
Yeah.
I thought she was just going to counseling because she didn't like me drinking. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
When I got out of, well, even in the Army, I noticed that people started pulling away. And I'd look at my wife and be like, well, I don't drink as much as this dude, or I don't drink as much as her.
Mm.
And she's like, yeah, but you drink a lot.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, I still don't drink as much as them. It wasn't how much they were drinking. It was the effect that it was having on me.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time I got out of the Army, let me back up a little bit. I came back to Georgia. I was on my way after I left Germany first to go to Fort Knox, Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
I came back to Georgia on PCS leave, permanent change of station.
Mm-hmm.
And I was driving my mom's car because mine was still on the boat coming from Germany to St. Louis.
Uh-huh.
And I went to one of the local bars thinking, okay, well, I'm only going to go have a couple drinks. I thought I only had a couple drinks.
Mm.
But I remember driving home. Yeah. I remember driving home and the wheel jumped out of my hand. Literally jumped out of my hand. The car jumped up on this island. I hit the damn sign. The sign bent down. And the only thing that was running through my mind was, fuck, I got to get out of here before the cops come.
Yeah.
That damn shit don't want to smell. I wasn't worried about being drunk. I didn't want them to smell alcohol on my breath.
Yeah.
So, my dumbass, I pulled into a dark parking lot, driving around in circles, looking in my rearview mirror, trying to see if there's oil leaking, and drove to my mom's house and parked the car. About 10 minutes later, I hear a knock on the door, and I'm like, what the fuck? So I look out the carport door, and I see all these blue and red lights. I was like, holy shit.
Oh, yeah.
And the cop looks at me, and he goes, man, he's like, you must be some kind of special person. I was like, what do you mean? He goes, we followed the oil trail. You left the trail of all the damn breadcrumbs, man.
Yeah.
So I spent the night in the drunk tank, and I have PTSD, and I was drunk. And the dude that was in the drunk tank with me, he kept flipping out. So I'm beating on the door of the drunk tank, and I'm yelling at the older lady down the hall. And I'm like, hey, you got to get me out of here before I fuck this dude up. Mm-hmm. And I'm beating on the door and beating on the door. Comes down and she goes, you got one more time to touch that door. And that was it. Next thing I know, I woke up the next morning and I asked about a phone call. So first I called my mom. She's like, hell no, what'd you do to my car? Blah, 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 blah. I'm not bailing you out.
Yeah.
So I called a bail bondsman. He came and got me out and told me, when you go to court, make sure you wear your uniform.
Yeah.
So I got my uniform on. I go to court. And before we go in, I'm talking to the solicitor / prosecutor, and he goes, I'll tell you what, I live in an Air Force town. I live in an Air Force town now. And he goes, but since it's an Air Force town in your Army, I'm going to recommend that he reduce the charge to, like, failure to maintain your vehicle, failure to maintain your lane, and improper lane change.
Mm-hmm.
We can't charge you with DUI because you weren't actually driving when they found you.
Yeah.
And we're not going to say anything about the sign because we don't want to mess up your security clearance.
Yeah.
Like, oh, cool. I caught a break.
Mm-hmm.
So I go to court. The judge says the same thing. The judge agrees to it, says we're going to fine you. I forgot how much the fine was. He goes, but I'm only giving you this break because I know if you're in the Army and you're PCSing, that means you're going to a unit that's about to deploy.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I get to Kentucky. They, lo and behold, three of the companies were already deployed. My company wasn't going anywhere.
Wow.
So I just chalked it up as a win.
Yeah.
Made the ticket off, kept drinking.
Yep.
Yeah, drinking and drinking and drinking. Mm. And let me back up to Germany. When I was stationed there, there was a lot of drinking and fights.
No, in Germany? In Germany? Drinking in Germany? That doesn't sound right.
Yeah, imagine that. But I could feel myself. It gets to the point. It got to the point where I could feel myself not wanting to drink.
Yeah.
I'd wake up in the morning and be like, okay, I'm not going to drink today.
Mm-hmm.
I got to go to work. So I would go to work. And by the time I was about, before I even got off work, I was thinking about having a cold beer.
Mm-hmm.
Had a shot of bourbon. But I'd get home and have a couple shots of bourbon.
Mm-hmm.
Then need a cold beer to cool off. Then the beer would make me feel bloated. So I'd drink a couple more shots of bourbon.
Mm-hmm.
Now my bourbon's empty and I still got half a beer. So I got to go get more bourbon because I know the beer is going to make me bloated. I don't know. Science.
Yeah. Drinking logic.
I'm in. Yeah. Yeah. So I had that checklist. Okay. Well, I don't drink in the morning. Yeah, sooner or later, that was gone.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not hiding my alcohol like they do in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't in the linen closet or in the back of the toilet or anything like that.
Yeah.
What I would do is I would go to the gym, then go to the liquor store. Mm. I'd get my beer and my bourbon. I'd leave my bourbon in my gym bag. After my family went to sleep, I'd get the bourbon out.
Mm.
But no, I wasn't hiding alcohol.
Yeah.
So, I wasn't trying to hide how much I was drinking.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, pretty soon if I didn't have to be at work till 3:30 in the afternoon, I'd have like a couple beers in the morning, a couple shots of bourbon because I'd feel bloated, lay back down, get up, go to work.
Mm.
And at this point, I'm drinking by myself because my wife had quit drinking years ago.
Yeah.
And we used to talk that I married my designated driver. I didn't realize at the time she because of my drinking.
Mm.
Oh, I'm not seeing a pattern at this point, yeah. You know?
Yeah.
And then I did. I started feeling suicidal, homicidal, PTSD messed fucking with me.
Yeah.
And I wanted to kill myself because I wanted to die at this point. But I was scared because if I failed, I was scared people would talk shit about me.
Mm. Wow.
That's crazy. Yeah. So one night I had my Wounded Warrior hat on.
Mm-hmm.
And young kid up north of Atlanta, there's a lot of MS-13 members. I know. And I can't remember when I pulled the gas station if I cut him off or if he cut me off. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I get out the car and he's talking shit, and he reached under the front seat. And as he's reaching under the front seat, I'm like, well, what you going to do? I was hoping he would shoot me.
Yeah.
You know, that way the Army Reserves, my family with the life insurance and all that.
Mm.
That's my mentality at that point.
Yeah.
And the lady run out of the gas station. She's like, whoa, 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 whoa. Oh, everybody calm down. So I get a pack of Newports. And I don't think I got any beer that night.
Mm-hmm.
But I end up going home. And I remember I went out on the balcony of the apartments we lived in. I was pouring three-finger shots in a tumbler and then dropping a couple ice cubes in there, telling my wife it was a two-finger shot with a lot of ice.
Yeah.
And and a bottle of beer. But I took a sip of the bourbon, and I almost threw up in my mouth. I couldn't drink it. And I've been praying, God, you know, God, please stop me from drinking so much. Not God, please stop me from drinking, period.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want it. I had to drink.
Yeah.
And like, okay, well, the bourbon's not going down right. Maybe the beer will fix that. So I took a sip of the beer, and I almost threw up in my mouth again. So I sat outside on the balcony trying to figure out what was going on. And that was a Saturday night. Monday morning, I went to the VA for anger issues.
Mm-hmm.
The lady at the VA, anyone that's ever been around the military, they know once you go to mental health or anything like that, they have you fill out a survey.
Yeah.
Right. Anytime you have any kind of alcohol-related incident, you fill out a survey. How much do you drink? How often do you drink? Do you ever drink alone? Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
I had so many alcohol-related incidents when I was in the Army. I learned to become a professional liar at this point. For real, man. I'd been to ASAP and CCC and all kind of other programs in the Army.
Uh-huh.
But I decided to get totally honest. And she looks at me after I fill out the survey. She looks at me. She goes, "I'm thinking about putting you in inpatient treatment." I was like, "For anger issues?" She's like, "No, you have a substance abuse problem."
Mm.
And I knew that I had a drinking problem, but I didn't know I was an alcoholic.
Yeah,
or I didn't want to admit that I was an alcoholic. I don't know. And if you've ever been in a VA hospital, you know that as soon as you walk in the doors, your cell phone just loses all signal.
Oh yeah.
Somehow I was able to call a buddy of mine on FaceTime, Facebook Messenger.
Uh-huh.
I was standing by the window and I'm talking to him. And me and Andy used to get drunk together with a crowd of people, and we'd get on a train where we were stationed at and end up like three towns over, go to a bar and just tear the bar up fighting.
Wow.
And the next morning get back to the train and go back like nothing happened.
Mm-hmm.
But I called Andy. I hadn't talked to Andy in like 4 years, 4 or 5 years. And I talked to him, and I'm like, "Hey, man, you won't believe this. These people want me to go to a damn substance abuse class." Now, don't get it twisted. I'm not judging anyone.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was talking, I said, "I don't smoke crack. I don't shoot heroin. I don't snort coke. Hell, I don't even smoke weed. Mm-hmm. I drink." And his response was this: "Quit being a knucklehead and go to the damn classes."
Mm.
At about 45 days, I found out Andy had been in the program for 2 years at this point.
Oh, wow.
So that's why when people say, "Is it odd or is it God?" You know, don't ask me why I called Andy.
Yeah.
But now I'm going to back. That was the beginning of my recovery. Now I'm going to back up to when I realized my life was unmanageable. After I got sober, I realized my life was unmanageable.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Eviction notices every couple months on the door. I thought that was normal because of the neighborhood we lived in.
Yeah.
Late warnings and last minute warnings and lights cut off. I thought that was normal.
Mm-hmm.
Took out a damn title pawn on my car to pay bills so I could have drinking money.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was normal. You know, all this stuff seemed normal to me because my mind was so twisted.
Yeah.
And then at this point, I also had my mind made up that recovery doesn't work because of my experiences as a kid with my dad.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, fuck that, you know, fuck AA, fuck NA, fuck that, and it doesn't work, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
But that. Andy's suggestion was the first suggestion I took.
Hmm.
And in the group counseling, one of the counselors said, "Hey, it's a weekend. I want everybody to go to a meeting." And the way the dude put it, almost like the Godfather, when he said, "I'm going to make him an offer he couldn't refuse."
Yep.
Or he can't refuse.
Yeah.
I'm like, I know legally he can't put hands on me, but the dude's big as hell. I'm no scrub, but he might put hands on me. So, and I was desperate enough after a week or so in this class, in these classes, to do something different.
Mm-hmm.
So that was it. I got my first sponsor. I got my first book that Sunday. Went back, got my first sponsor that next week. My first sponsor, met my grand sponsor and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And then started working the steps to recovery. Is my life still unmanageable? Hell yeah, because every once in a while I get the good idea fairy that lands on my shoulder.
Oh, of course.
It says, hey, Dave, check this out. This is a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can think twice about it, I usually call somebody.
Yeah.
So, and usually their response is, are you crazy? So that shows where my manageability of my life is.
Mm-hmm.
Now I do have a sponsee. I've been fired by one sponsee. I had three sponsees relapse.
Mm-hmm.
When I first got sober, and I always kept going back to my first sponsor, my grand sponsor. I'm like, why are these guys relapsing? And blah, 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 blah.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, my grand sponsor looked at me one day and he's like, you can't give away what you don't have.
Ooh. Ooh.
Yeah, deep, huh?
Yeah.
And it took me a minute to realize that I can't give away sobriety if I don't have it.
Yeah.
All I've done at that point was put the plug in the jug, work some steps, and change some things about my life.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't actually working the program.
Yeah.
Now I moved down here. I moved down here right before my mom passed away.
Mm.
And when my mom passed away, the farthest thing from my mind was a drink. I called my dad's family. They still live in Alabama and Pittsburgh and all. And I got cousins in Pittsburgh on my mom's side.
Mm-hmm.
And all these people flew in and drove in out of the blue. Just, they dropped everything they were doing to come take care of me.
Wow.
I was just like, damn.
Wow.
People do love me.
Yeah.
At this point, this is a few 24 hours in.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, I'm just of myself. Probably because where I'm at now, living physically,
mm-hmm.
because it's a small town. So there's a lot of cross addiction.
Yeah.
People come into the rooms that I go to and, you know, they have nothing to do with alcohol, but they just feel more comfortable. So that's why I said, I don't judge anyone.
Yeah.
We all got our vices.
Mm-hmm.
So, after everything was all said and done, the first people I called when my mom passed away were people in the program.
Mm-hmm.
And then I called a couple other friends that had died either high school with or that I still know and that we're still real close with.
Mm-hmm.
The only people I talked to outside of people in the program basis because they're earth people that a dude's like a brother from another mother. He can have like half a beer and be like, oh, I'm good.
Yeah.
And today, all these years later, I still look like, who the fuck does that?
Mm-hmm.
Who only has it? You know?
Yep. Not part of my story.
Exactly. But now I'm able to go, well, right after my mom passed away, a really good friend of mine in the program looks at me and he goes, you know why you didn't drink, right? I was like, no, I just didn't think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, that's a testimonial. And off the bat, my ego starts to swell. My head wouldn't have fit through a barn door, right?
Mm-hmm.
And because I was like, hell yeah, I'm just that good. And I was like, oh, wait, that was higher power.
Yeah.
So now the one sponsor that fired me because I just didn't have time. And I told him that when he asked me to be a sponsor. I was like, I will get you started on the steps as your temporary.
Yeah.
We will work together a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to suggest that you find someone that has a lot of time.
Yeah.
But I will get you started.
Mm-hmm.
Because now I have sobriety that I can give away. And now that I'm sober, I've been through the steps a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
I'm seeing all these cliches come to life.
Yeah.
You know?
Don't you hate when that happens?
Oh, hell yeah.
Dude, dude, it sucks. Like, in early recovery, like, listening to all those cliches, and you're like, man, that's some bullshit. And just, it just sounds good, it rhymes, whatever. And then that time in your life, it fucking comes true, and you're like, those motherfuckers. I was like, they were right. And you're just like, damn. You got to call your sponsor and be like, yeah, that makes sense now. God damn it.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's forever making that popping noise. Yeah, just pulled your head out of your ass, huh?
Oh, man. My grand sponsor's in the sober fellowship, too. And he says that to me all that time. He's like, just waiting to hear that popping sound.
Oh. Hell yeah. But no, life is good now. We have a 4-year-old daughter and a 17-year-old daughter.
Nice.
Do I still have fears about my 17-year-old daughter following in my footsteps? Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's all she knew for the first 13 years of her life when I was home.
Yeah.
Yeah. She's come home drunk a couple times as a teenager. And I chalked that up to being a teenager in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And other things that, you know, I talked to my sponsor about, and he's like, well, can you do anything to change the situation? No, but no. Not no, but can you do anything to change the situation?
Mm.
No.
Yeah.
Okay. So what are you stressing about?
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'm stressing because I can't change the damn situation. You know, but if you can't change the situation, shut the fuck up. I'm like, yeah. God, if life was that easy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah. One of the things I heard in one of the rooms was, if you want to know how well you're working your program, go home to small kids.
Oh.
Deal with small kids being small kids.
Oof.
That sounds hard.
Yeah, that sounds hard.
Yeah.
I deal with a cat, and I'm like, yeah, that's good enough for me for now.
I got a cat, a 4-year-old daughter, 17-year-old daughter, a wife. All of them are females.
Ooh.
And me and the youngest are the only one that the cat doesn't bite.
Yeah, I feel your pain, man. I'm the only boy, and I had 4 sisters.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's rough. All right. Well.
No, but now life is good.
Mm-hmm.
Life is really good. I can say I got 2 promotions in a year.
Awesome.
One, according to company policy, I didn't qualify for because of time.
Mm-hmm.
But my boss was like, well, I'm going to offer it to you anyway.
Nice.
And the first thing out of my mouth was, well, how much do I have to travel? And she goes, you'll be home every night when you do travel. And I said, hell yeah.
Nice.
And she's like, well, oh, life's not that easy. Slow down, Sparky. She goes, you gotta get training before you get this promotion. I was like, well, fuck it. Let's do it.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So.
All right.
That's where I'm at now.
All right. Well, we
getting ready to retire with the Army and working for a company that I actually love my job. It's not like it's work.
Mm-hmm.
I treat it like I do sobriety.
Yeah.
Okay, what now?
Well, I was about to ask, well, what do you do for work?
Yeah, I'm not going to say the company, but I sell sports nutrition.
Oh.
Yeah, cool, man.
Cool. That's what's up. All right. Well, I think we got a few questions for you. I don't know if I started last time.
Okay.
You start every time.
Okay, yeah, I start right. Every time. All right. You talked about this, how like you, and like no judgment, but like you during your like active drinking, you would like compare yourself out to like people who were doing coke or shooting dope or like all these other addicts. So how did comparing your drinking with other addicts, how did that sort of like keep you sick and like extend your own addiction?
Because I used to snort a lot of coke. I used to snort a lot of meth. But wow. I was always looking at them like, well, man, this dude's stealing TVs and breaking into houses and,
mm-hmm.
you know, all that to feed his addiction. Meanwhile, I'm not paying my light bill so I can go get a case of beer.
Yeah.
So, you know, And then it made me feel better about myself because I wasn't doing drugs.
Yeah.
Anymore. But, well, not doing. I wasn't doing illegal drugs anymore.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, but now I go to family gatherings in Alabama and half of them smoke weed. They're either smoking weed and drinking, or they're sober, which is crazy as heck.
Yeah.
All right, Eric.
Yeah, that shit kept me sick for a long time.
What you got, Eric? So, this is one of the questions we usually go to. You know, once you stop drinking and using, different behaviors tend to pop up in our life, which, you know, we might take a bit too far. Something for me, for example, is work. I might work a bit too much. Just a little bit. Or, you know, I might binge watch something. You know, when I get on a show, I'm going to watch it all the way through. So how has other behaviors or, you know, activities manifested themselves in addictive ways in your life?
I was lifting weights in the Army and working out and all that. And after I was lifting more, the more I drank, the more I worked out. So I didn't look like an alcoholic, if that makes sense. After I quit, for the longest time, I wouldn't even look at a gym. And then when I got back in the gym, I didn't have that anger feed me anymore. But then when I found other motivations for working out, now it gets to the point at times that I got to catch it. I'll miss the gym. If I miss a workout I planned on going to, I'll get restless, irritable, and discontent. So for me, yeah, getting to the gym.
All right. That's a common one. That's a common, like, substitute addiction. Like, people get clean and then they just start beefing up. All right. Go ahead.
Oh, I got bullied into going to the gym when I was in the Army.
Oh, yeah.
Then when I wanted to compete as a bodybuilder. And then now that I'm older, I realize I don't want to be I don't want to compete, but I still want to be big and intimidating.
So, nice.
And I got a 17 daughter. But who's just sniffing around the door.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you got to look as scary as possible.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, on top of that, like, you're a veteran, so I'm sure, like, you just wear, like, a pair of fatigues, maybe, like, polish a double barrel in your rocking chair on the front porch, and you're good to go.
Actually, I don't own any guns.
All right.
I love guns. Don't get it twisted. I don't think I'm mentally at that point where I'd be safe for society to own one.
Well, I appreciate
that. But yeah. I'll drink a free workout and knock out like 150 push-ups and come outside of my wife beater.
Oof.
So they see the tattoo, I'm nice and charged up, and they're like, oh, shit.
I'm just imagining that, and I'm like, I don't want to deal with that.
I usually don't shake the dude's hand the first time I meet him.
So, did your military service, did that, like, exacerbate your drinking in any way?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It gave me an excuse. Because we would be hard all week. And then when some Saturdays I work just as hard and or go to the field for 28 days, 29 days, and then come home, deploy, home, barbecues, especially in Germany when you're away from, like, your family in the States.
Yeah.
You're more like a family, your unit.
Yeah.
Of course, military functions. You know, being have they love having grog.
Yeah.
Where person dumps a bottle of 151 in this big steel pot. Ooh. And it represents, I don't know, it represents the Apache helicopter. Somebody comes and dumps a bottle of vodka in, and it represents the M1 Abrams. And then someone comes and dumps in like a can of Hawaiian or a bottle of Hawaiian Punch, and it represents the mechanics fixing this stuff, you know.
Huh.
And then everybody's supposed to drink. I smelled it a couple of times, and I'm just like, even then, at the worst of my drink, I was like, hell no.
Ooh. All right. Total. This is a fun question. Is there, like, which service branch are, like, the biggest drinkers? No offense to, like, any of them, the Air Force, Marines, Navy, any of them, but because, like, me, I've never been in the service or anything, but I've always heard that, like, the Navy guys are the big drinkers.
Yeah, I don't know. I've partied with all branches.
Mm-hmm.
Usually Air Force guys, they're the cooler drinkers. Where I live at is an Air Force base, so there's a lot of Air Force vets and Air Force airmen in the rooms. But
what are they drinking? Martinis, usually, looking fancy,
like apple teenies and shit. but usually, I found it was usually the Army or the Marines.
Yeah.
Navy guys drank a lot, but it's the Army and the Marines.
All right. That makes sense. All right. What do you got, Eric?
Let's see. So, what does, you know, recovery kind of takes the form of many different things for many different people. You know, and for some people that's fellowship, for some people that's therapy, you know, for some people that's yoga. Or, you know, all of those things combined, what does recovery look like for you today?
Today, it's I'm able to handle things. I'm able to deal with my emotions instead of bottling them up.
Mm-hmm.
But it is the fellowship. And that's why I said earlier, I don't judge anyone because where I live is a small town and there's a lot across the distance. You'll meet very few people in the rooms that I go to. They're just strictly drinkers. Very few.
Yeah.
You can count them on one hand in 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's usually mainly the fellowship and knowing that if the good idea fairy lands on my shoulder, I can call someone. And if I'm struggling in the middle of the night, I can call someone.
Mm-hmm.
And usually not my sponsor because his old ass goes to sleep at like 9:30. but yeah, it's just the fellowship mainly. Getting together for barbecues and going out to eat dinner.
Yeah.
And a New Year's Eve party every year.
Nice.
All right. That's what sobriety looks like.
All right.
And now I'm able to tell some people that, yeah, I'm in recovery. And they look at me like, you? Surprise, motherfucker.
Can you be, are you still active military?
No, I did almost 18 years.
Oh, wow.
And got out and then went reserves.
Oh, okay.
Everyone looks at me, and they're like, you only needed 2 more years. I was like, yeah, I've got 4 deployments to Iraq. I was never shot or blown up.
Yeah.
I wouldn't take a chance to go to Afghanistan.
No.
That and at the time, my drinking, it was either the gym, drinking, or spend time with the family.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed college to get promoted.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have time to go to college. Oh, gee, I had time to drink, but I just didn't have time to go to college.
Mm-hmm.
So...
funny how that works.
Yeah.
Was there like in your active drinking, was there like a stigma? Like, cause you talked about how throughout your story, like different periods, you like knew you had a drinking problem, but for whatever reason, I don't know, didn't pursue recovery necessarily. So was there a stigma like in your mind of being an alcoholic that you didn't want to like admit to yourself or didn't want to identify yourself as an alcoholic?
Yeah, like that. My dad was like a known alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And as much as I love my dad to this day, he's been dead for years. Mm-hmm. But I still got nothing but love for my dad. I just didn't want to end up an alcoholic.
Yeah.
You know, a labeled alcoholic.
Yeah.
All right.
That, and I was scared that if I got any kind of help, that I wouldn't have any more fun.
Yeah.
All right. What do you got, Eric? Got any more?
Got a couple more, I think.
You do yours, and then we'll do the Twitter question.
Okay. All right. So you said you worked all 12 steps?
Yes.
All right. So, out of all 12 steps, you can only pick one. Which one was your favorite?
Step one.
Step one. All right. Why? Why step one? It's a great answer.
Because when I was at that jumping off point,
mm-hmm.
and I realized that I was an alcoholic, mm-hmm. it was freeing. But I still didn't get the second part of step one, that my life was unmanageable.
Mm-hmm.
And working with my first sponsor, he's like, okay, well, did you pay all your bills on time? No. Because when you were in the Army, didn't they make you go to, like, the military version of rehab a couple times? Well, yeah. And he goes, that's unmanageability.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it was like eye-opening. And freeing to be able to say, yes, I'm an alcoholic.
Yeah. All right. Awesome. And, all right, fast forwarding in the steps a little bit, talking about, like, the amends process, like, you, with your wife and your daughter, how has that amends process been? Like, just tell me about that.
With my oldest daughter and my wife, it's a living amend.
Mm-hmm.
I apologize to both of them verbally.
Yeah.
My oldest daughter, she holds me accountable, and yeah, it pisses me off because I still get in my own shit, and I still got an ego, and I don't want anyone, especially a teenager, to hold me accountable.
Mm.
When I start getting in my own head.
Yeah.
But there's some things that she said, well, you know, it's going to take me some time to get over this
mm-hmm.
or that. Like the time I pissed in her closet.
Oh.
Oh,
that sucks.
The time I pissed in her. Ooh. Yeah. Other times I came home, my face busted open.
Mm.
And she's like, what the hell happened to you? I was like, oh, nothing. I fell.
Mm.
Then she's looking at my hands like, you were fighting. Mm. So that, and when I do get in my own head and I go back and apologize, she's like, you know what you told me, right? I was like, what's that? And she goes, don't apologize if you're not going to change your behavior.
Yeah.
I'm like, that's this asshole. My wife, I'm forever apologizing to. She doesn't hold me accountable like my oldest daughter,
mm-hmm.
but I'm forever apologizing to her. Even if I think that I did something wrong, I'll go back and apologize. Usually a couple days later.
Yeah.
It's like, what are you apologizing for? And it's like, because of this and this and this. She's like, oh, that shit don't mean nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. It's been eating my lunch.
Yeah.
I'm like nonchalant about it.
All right, Eric, cool. I am officially out of questions.
All right, well, we'll move to the Twitter question. So each week we, you know, bring a question from Twitter that has been asked. So I'm going to butcher the shit out of all of these handles and people's names, but the person's name is Shields a Bub 2. That's the handle. It's just Shields a Bub. But the question is a discussion more or less between us about how people can stay sober both literally and emotionally during trying times. And they're, you know, looking at this more from a macro perspective. So when larger scale events, things happen. So trying to think, like, you know, for our example, like when the flood happened recently in Old Ellicott City.
Oh, yeah.
Or if you look at like hurricanes down like south, you know, or like the fire in California. When bigger things happen, how can you stay sober? Do you have any thoughts on, like, I don't know what's going down in Georgia, or if any macro things have happened for you, but, or even like politically, like if, you know, you're...
Stop saying macro.
Sorry.
You sound like a dick.
Sorry, man.
That's a whole nother topic, but, how do I stay sober in like drastic times? I usually get deeper into my program.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounds cliche, but knowing that it's not going to last forever. And then I ask myself if I can do something to change the situation. Or if the answer is yes, and I come up with a couple of solutions, I ask myself, am I going to do anything to change the situation?
Mm-hmm.
And then, I don't know, I had some water damage in my house, and I was talking to somebody in one of the rooms, and I was just like, you know, the old me would have drank over that shit.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it turned out to be not as serious as I thought it was, the old me still would have drank over that.
Yeah.
He was like, why didn't you? And I was like, I don't know. Just knowing that there wasn't either a whole lot that I could do about it to get it fixed, ride out the storm.
Yeah.
That, and it's amazing how people will open their arms and open their hearts when I'm in need.
Yeah.
With no expectations of any kind of recompense, you know, or compensation.
Yeah.
So even after the few 24 hours I have, I'm still working on asking for help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's just a general man thing. Asking for help is always, always troublesome.
Yep. Fuck that.
Yeah.
I don't ask, like, I'll search every aisle of Home Depot before I ask for fucking help.
I don't know. I kind of want to answer that as well. How have I stayed clean in, like, drastic times? I'll bring up something that happened in, like, my early recovery. Like, I had 14 months clean, and my first sponsor was murdered in at the Columbia Mall, completely it was just random gun violence. Like, there was never any premeditation or connection with the shooter. Yeah, 14 months clean, my sponsor was murdered. My first sponsor was murdered. And just like you said, like, I it's the people in recovery that help get me through that. Not necessarily like step work or any of the cliches. It was literally the people, like, just rocking with them. 'Cause, like, he was a pretty prominent person in our area, and he was a young kid in recovery. He was only like 24 and he had years clean. And so yeah, it was tough to deal with, but it was the other people in recovery showing up and hugging each other and crying with each other and, like, just holding together in that storm that really got me through recovery. So, like, more bigger than, like, the steps and anything like that, like you said, it's people just showing up for other people when they need it, because we all get a turn in recovery. Like, shit's gonna go down. Like, there's gonna be floods, there's gonna be fires, there's gonna be deaths, we're gonna lose jobs. Like, shit's gonna happen in recovery, so we're all gonna get a turn. And we can't be selfish, like, with our love. Like, we got to show up for people just like we want people to show up for us. So it'll always come full circle. It's just a matter of when.
Yeah. Like when my mom died.
Mm-hmm.
I just moved down here not too long before that, but I was already going to the meetings because mm-hmm. there's only like one clubhouse in this town where I'm at, and then 20 and 30 minutes away there's other meetings. But mm-hmm. There's one of the old timers there showed up, and I was like, I know this guy from around the clubhouse,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't know him personally.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, my family from Alabama is like, who's the old white guy in a cowboy hat?
Yeah, man.
It's just, but he was there.
Yeah, it's just people just showing up. And, like, sometimes that's all you need. You just need somebody to show up
mm-hmm.
just so you don't feel alone. And, like, you're like, oh, just that presence is empowering, and it gives me strength.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially if I'm spun up and I'm able to talk to somebody, giving it voice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just
versus holding it in.
Yeah. Just getting things off your chest is crucial. And yeah. The relationships are the heartbeat of recovery, period.
Yes.
All right. Well, I think that's it. We'd like to thank our guest David for joining us today. We're gonna give you a golf clap. We can't clap loud. Everybody wonder, like, I don't know. I don't want anybody to be insulted. We can't clap loud. We don't want to hurt the microphones.
That's true.
All right. And we're going to give you one quick minute to give a really short, condensed message to anybody out there listening to this who's struggling with drinking, addiction, like whatever. What message do you have for them to just help them get through?
Pick up the phone. Mm-hmm. If you don't have a phone because you lost it, sold it, or whatever, go to a clubhouse.
Mm-hmm.
Find somebody to talk to.
Yeah.
Because it's amazing how whenever you're going through something, you feel like you're the only one going through it.
Yeah.
And you one person, and lo and behold, either they're going through something similar or they just got done going through it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? It's out there, man. Just reach your hand out.
Yeah.
That's all I got. Like, just reach your hand out.
Mm. Nice. That's perfect. Love it. All right. Well, again, thank you for coming on. Here at Podcast Recovery, we are aiming to expand the scope of support for recovering addicts. Accessibility and convenience of helpful services is paramount to combating addiction. We work to bring the message of recovery to every addict, wherever and whenever it is needed. We believe that a powerful voice of recovery should be obtainable, practical, and at the touch of a button. Every addict deserves to hear a message of hope, and Podcast Recovery is here to provide it. So follow us on Twitter, check us out on Facebook, like, share, subscribe, retweet, all that good stuff. Thanks for joining us tonight. Most importantly, everybody out there, stay safe and stay clean.